The 1994 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium presents session number 270, Rocky Mountain Umpire, a conversation with Sam Taylor. Interviewer, Levi S. Peterson.
Ladies and gentlemen, we'll begin. Is the microphone working? Now, this is to be an interview, and I'm not quite certain how we'll manage getting back and forth between one microphone between two of us. But the important thing is to have Sam Taylor speaking and to have Levi Peterson not getting in the way. Now, a quick introduction of Samuel W. Taylor for the audience. And we will try to finish the formalities in time for comments, questions from the audience. At 87, Samuel W. Taylor looks back upon a long and successful career as a freelance writer. Few professions are more rigorous or more littered with failures than freelance writing. Born in Provo in 1907, Taylor was the son of an apostle and grandson of a prophet. His intimate connections to Mormon polygamy are demonstrated by the fact that he had some 35 siblings, of whom only he and a handful of sisters presently survive. He married Elizabeth Gay Dimmock, followed her to California, and made a home in Redwood City, near San Francisco, his longtime residence. Upon graduating from Brigham Young University, he gave up all other kinds of work and centered upon freelance writing. At first, he supported himself with writing for stories for pulp magazines. Later, he broke into more lucrative markets, the slick magazines of national circulation. All told, his stories number in the hundreds. Some of them were made into films. Following service as a military correspondent during World War II, Taylor began to write books. These include a documentary, novels, biographies, and histories. Close to a dozen of Taylor's books deal with Mormon history and culture. He has looked upon his people, the Mormons, from a certain removal, perhaps influenced by the trauma of the expulsion of his father, John W. Taylor, from the Quorum of the Twelve and his later excommunication. Certainly, Taylor's personality, as it has appeared in his essays as well as in his books, is experienced, skeptical, even a little cynical, always funny, and always cogent. His style reads easily and finds its felicitous metaphors among the speech of ordinary people. Now, we have a prepared list of questions that he will respond to, but he will start by, he says he wants to respond to this introduction I've just made. So, Sam, please.
Well, I am highly flattered by that introduction, and it reminds me of a similar introduction when I spoke to a service group, a service club in San Mateo. The master of ceremony said, "It is a great honor to introduce this world famous author whose works you all know and love. His name is a household word." And then he leaned over to the other side of the lectern and says, "Who the hell is he?" Now, the slight difference between that and Lehi's introduction is that he told who I am.
I think we'll try to operate sitting. Can you see him from over there? Yes or no? I will sit and we'll, excuse me, Sam, and we'll operate this way. Would you like to tell us a bit why you decided at BYU, as you graduated as a young man, to enter upon a career as a freelance writer? And talk.
Well, I began publishing in national magazines when I was a student, and also my mother had the ambition to write the story of my father, and so I embarked and somehow survived as a writer from then on.
Okay, thank you. During World War II, Sam was, as I said, in the military, and he served in England and did some writing, in fact, for the military. He was a correspondent. You've said, Sam, that you hadn't written anything about the Mormons before World War II, and that Hugh B. Brown, who was mission president in London, urged you to do so. Do you want to elaborate a little on that, your relationship with Hugh B. Brown?
Well, Hugh Brown was mission president at that time. His headquarters was an old red brick mansion far west of London, in the West End, on Nightingale Lane. And when I wasn't away on a story, I dropped by for Sunday services. The mission, as such, was on hold, but he maintained a place to keep base and held services for the American servicemen and women of all ranks. And he urged me to write about my own people, which I hadn't done at that time. And the first thing I did, I wrote an article, 20,000 Amateur Chaplains, about LDS servicemen who held the priesthood and were fully qualified to be chaplains, except they didn't have the commission. Well, now, I sent that to my New York agent instead of the Deseret News, and it was too specialized for the national audience. But that was the first thing I wrote about the Mormons.
Okay, thank you. Are you hearing all right? The way that, okay, we'll operate this way then. That's good. Hold it a little closer. Shall we have him hold it a little closer? All right, I'll help on that. Thank you for that. Or do that. Now, when you had returned from military service and got on with your career as a freelance writer, one of your most successful early stories was a novel named The Man with My Face. It was published in 1948 as a six-part thriller in Liberty magazine, but then it was published as a novel. And what I've read that it appeared in many printings, it's still in print, it appeared in 11 foreign editions, 8 of them in foreign languages. Now, how do you account for the popularity of that novel, The Man with My Face?
Well,
directly into it there.
Yeah. It had a good gimmick. It opens up. It's written in the first person, and I place it my own home in Redwood City and use my own phone number, which I found out was a mistake. But I commute to San Francisco, where I am an accountant, and I come home to Redwood City, and my wife isn't waiting for me. And I call her up, and she says, "Who's speaking, please?" And I said, "The Green Hornet." And she says, "Mr. Horner, who are you anyway?" And finally, I took a taxi home, and as I walked in the door, here's my wife, my best friend, his wife, and the man with my face, my exact double, sitting there playing cards. And they say, "Who the hell are you?" And I start getting feisty, and they stick my own dog on me, and my own dog bites me. Now that can be explained. Of course, the dog was a ringer, just like the man was a ringer. And we go on from there.
Thank you. I'll reiterate what I said a moment ago in my introduction. Sam wrote literally hundreds of stories, and some of them became novels, and this is with a high popular appeal, and you can see why that would have been. A significant part of your career, Sam, was with the movies, and you did quite a bit of script writing, and in fact, you had a great deal to do. You might tell us about it, with The Absent-Minded Professor, which was nominated for the Best Written American Comedy in 1961 by the Writers Guild of America. Could you tell us a bit about that film script?
Well, yes. Hollywood is a madhouse. The money's good, but except for the Disney studio, and I like to work there. I spent three times there, and once was about The Absent-Minded Professor. I had written a series of fantasies for Liberty Magazine under the title Letters to the President. I was writing to Franklin D. Roosevelt telling him how to win the war. And one of the stories was about Professor Rhodes, an eccentric who I said, "Mr. President, you'll be happy to learn that the rubber shortage is over. We have plenty of rubber. It's a synthetic product, and its only drawback is that it bounces slightly higher than it drops." And this professor cooked it up in a beaker and poured it in with a gas tank of his Model T and caught this rubber, which Walt called flubber, as it dripped out of the exhaust pipe. And so, in testing it out, the professor put some on his heels and started to bounce and got higher and higher and had an awful time getting down. And another story was about how a device had been invented to suspend the law of gravity. And so I took a trip in a Ford that flew around, and those two Disney bought and combined them into The Absent-Minded Professor. Now, when you saw Disney on screen, smiling, relaxed, debonair. That wasn't the Walt when he was working. He was a perfectionist. A genius is one who has the capacity for taking infinite pains, and he never was satisfied. The first, the second, the third, the fourth, the fifth, maybe the 100th time he had to rewrite it. And I was there at the studio as he was cutting the professor, and he invited a new audience into the studio projection room each day to get audience reaction. And as it was shown, he was sitting in the back, and a man beside him with a clipboard, and Walt would lean over and whisper, and next time you'd see changes. For instance, the Ford is flying over Washington, D.C., and the general says, "Shoot it out of the sky." And an officer behind him says, "Well, sir, it might fall on Congress." And the general doesn't take as if that wouldn't be a bad idea. Well, the laugh smothered this next line. So the next time, when the officer says it might fall on Congress, the general turns and turns back as the laugh rises and subsides, and then you hear the next line. That was Walt at work.
Thank you. That's a nice insight. Your novel, Heaven Knows Why, was published in 1948. And it's one of your earliest books about Mormons. It's now been around for a couple of generations, and it's been praised critically by Richard Craycroft. I'll simply say for those in the audience that may not have read it, it's a fine comedy about a deceased grandfather who returns to Earth as a spirit to see that the good folks in his former rural environment are duly rewarded and the bad ones are duly punished. And I think that's about the way it turns out. Heaven knows why. What is your perception, Sam, of this novel and the reception it has had among Mormon readers?
Well, it ran first as a serial in Collier's Magazine, which at that time had 6 million circulation. And then it became a book. And it received excellent reviews nationally. But in Zion, the roof fell in. I was making fun of sacred things. So for 30 years, I was in the doghouse, and I was hit with every type of abuse that they could find tongue to. You see, the Mormons had never seen humor before. It was... pro-Mormon, anti-Mormon, for or against, black or white. And this was a funny story, and they were dumbfounded. I was making light of sacred things. And so after 30 years in the doghouse, Richard Craycroft of BYU phoned me and talked some. And I talked to him, and I sent him some material. And he wrote an article which appeared in Sunstone called Samuel W. Taylor and Heaven Knows Why, and he told the saints it was funny. And so there was a paperback coming out, and I wrote a preface complimenting the saints on their mature sense of humor. And since that time, there have been two paperback editions which sold out quickly, and another one is due possibly next year.
Good. So we appreciate hearing that. Now, your book, Family Kingdom, appeared in 1951, and it's a wonderfully personalized biography about your father and his six wives and 16 children. 36. Are you good heavens? Yes. Excuse me. My glasses go back. He wouldn't forget that, would he? 36 children. Now, you said that you feared this book might get you cut off from the church. What was there about it?
Well, I talked with President Heber J. Grant, and he advised me strongly not to write this book. He said, use a more worthy subject. Well, it was my father, my family, and an honest book about how it was to live in a plural family had never been written. If I didn't, who would do it? And so I ran counter to Grant's advice, and, well, the official word was out. Don't do it. I had interviewed the wives 4 and 5, Roxy and Rhoda, and they talked freely. And then subsequently they asked for my notes to be returned. I sent them back but kept a carbon copy. And people were reached. Now, one man, I phoned him, and he said, did I know John W. Taylor? I used to sign his name for him. By the time I met him, he said, well, yes, I knew your father. Say hello. I really didn't really know him at all. And that sort of reaction kept going. And finally, I realized the only person who couldn't be reached and knew the story was my mother. But I interviewed her over a period of 13 years, and I couldn't break through the mother-son relationship. And she could tell more to a stranger on a bus than she could tell me. So finally, I made a trip back home, and I said, Mother, you've got to come to California with me, and we'll talk about this then. And, oh, I can't do it, Samuel. I have my Relief Society, my Daughters of the Utah Pioneers, my petunias will wilt, the lawn will go wild. And my brother Raymond said, Mother, if you want that book written, go with Sam. So we went, and we stopped at Grantsville, where she was born. And the house where she was born was gone except for a corner of the stone wall. The first wife, Maria, had an adobe house. It was completely gone except for the stone foundation. The third wife, Polly, had a house in the willows near the creek, and it was still standing, but as we opened the door, we saw a hobo asleep, so we didn't go in. And this started her thinking back, and she didn't say much. From then on, I didn't interrupt her thoughts. And so next morning, about 8:30, after breakfast, we went out to my office. I have a little shack out behind the house where I work. And she sat on the couch, and I sat in my back to her at the typewriter, and she began to talk. A free association of things, going back and forth. And when she'd pause, I'd shoot a question, and she'd keep on. She said, "Samuel, I don't know how you'll keep straightening this out. That's my problem. Keep talking." And so we worked all day, and it got to be 8 o'clock at night, and I was getting wobbly. And I said, "Mother, you look awfully tired. Let's knock it off." She says, "Oh, I feel fine. Let's keep on another couple of hours." Well, that went on for 10 days, and I had the core of my book. Of course, I had to fill it in. I took trips to Canada where my father had gigantic projects. He always had gigantic projects. His letterhead said large tracks only, and Mexico, where he had at one time three wives. At that time he had a wife in the United States, a wife in Canada, and three wives, including my mother, in Mexico, and all three countries were happy about it. But I spent a year writing it. And then, of course, you always wrestle about the title of a book. I have my memoirs coming out, and I'm wrestling with them. And they wanted to call it Papa Was a Polygamist. And I had spent too much time to have a cheap title, so it ended up as Family Kingdom. And it had two hardback editions, a paperback edition, and Sam Weller put out another edition, so it's still in print.
Thank you. Sam, tell us a little bit about what sense of family unity you have with 35, 36 siblings and all those aunts.
Well, we were very close, actually. We were urged to say, never to cut your brothers and sisters in half. They were brothers and sisters no matter who the mother was. And I lived with each of the plural wives at one time or another. And they were superb people. Their husband had died years ago, leaving them with large families. But never a word of complaint. And it's almost unbelievable. My father died when I was 8 years old, and he left 36 children, most of them young. Yet no single child became a police problem. Now the juvenile delinquency is associated with fatherless families. But My father was gone, but he was there. My mother's most severe rebuke when I got into mischief, which was often, was, "What would your father think of this?" She never spanked me. Didn't need to. That was enough. He was there.
Thank you. Sam, would you be willing to talk a little to us about your feelings or about the controversial action taken against your father? Is that something you'd like to address or not?
Well, yes. He was excommunicated officially because of taking wives after the manifesto. The real reason was that a neighbor named Ed Abbott, who was supposedly a friend, blew the whistle on him during the Smoot investigation, and Reed Smoot demanded that he be disciplined. So he was tossed to the wolves to keep Reed Smoot in the Senate. Except for that, I'm sure he would have been like thousands of other polygamists, latter-day polygamists, who maintained their good name and membership.
Thank you. Sam, in 1971, you published a book called Nightfall at Nauvoo. And I'll say to those in the audience that may not have read it, it's a highly readable history about the rise and fall of the short-lived Mormon city on the banks of the Mississippi. And I'll comment that it has a very fiction-like focus upon character and a very lucid style, very fast-paced narrative. But tell us a bit about that, and incidentally, why were you attracted to Nauvoo, particularly as a topic?
Well, I wasn't at first until T. Edgar Lyon, who was an official in the Nauvoo Restoration Project, he was on one of these Know Your Religion circuits, and I heard him talk about Nauvoo, and I was fascinated about it, and so I began researching, and finally wrote the book, I guess.
All right. It's been said that the thesis of this book is that the Mormons themselves were responsible for their expulsion from the city. Is that a fair statement or not?
That's absolutely true. The Mormons at Nauvoo had a charter that gave them the status of a city-state. Their court was superior to county courts and claimed even to be superior to state courts. They had the Nauvoo Legion, a well-drilled militia, larger than the state militia. And so the river bottoms, it was on the bank of the Mississippi, and the river bottoms had notorious gangs of outlaws, horse thieves, killers, counterfeiters, every type of criminal. And they looked across the river at this closely knit society, all for one, one for all, And they said, what an opportunity. They moved in, sang hymns, paid 10% tithing, which is a bargain. The organized crime always pays for protection. It's a lot more. And they kept going at the same old stand. So Nauvoo, the city of the saints, came to have an underground comparable to that of large cities like New York and London. They even had a brothel on the hill for the convenience of, I hope not, the Mormons. And, I was challenged about this. Kenneth Godfrey, for instance, wrote an article. With 167 footnotes proving how wrong I was, he said he carefully avoided just four footnotes, which would have demolished his elaborate house of cards. And he said there was no crime problem at Nauvoo. It was peaches and cream. Well, if that was the case, why did Hosea Stout, the chief of police, enlist a police force of 500 men for a city of 12,000? During my boyhood in Provo, it was about the same size, predominantly LDS, and the police force was less than a dozen.
Okay, thank you. In 1976, you published a biography of your grandfather, a very fine and closely detailed book. The Kingdom or Nothing, The Life of John Taylor, Militant Mormon, is the title. And in the opinion of many, this is your finest book, written with a passionate eloquence derived from your affinity for this beleaguered ancestor who rose to become president and prophet of the Utah Church. Now, you were born long after your grandfather's death, but did you grow up with some sense of his personality nonetheless?
No, I didn't grow up with it, but as I became an adult, I became aware of his contribution to the Mormon culture. He followed Brigham Young, and Brigham Young ran a one-man show. It wasn't with the First Presidency and the Council of the Twelve, it was Brigham. And John Taylor, for instance, canceled the numbered ballot. Under Brigham, the ballots were numbered so that they could check to see that you voted correctly. He abolished that. He administered under a renaissance of liberty, and Brigham Young was rather paranoid about some things. For instance, he forbid mining in Utah. That meant that much of Utah's mineral wealth went to the Gentiles, notably the Bingham Copper Mine. And that's not the matter, I guess.
Your grandfather is noted for his uncompromising stand on polygamy. Would you share with us your attitude toward that?
Well, John Taylor was the last pioneer, the last president to hold fast to Joseph Smith Mormonism. And that became an embarrassment to the modern church, who have dehydrated and adulterated and bowdlerized our history until it's hardly recognizable today from what it was. Now, for instance, the change has been so great that when I was doing research for Nightfall at Nauvoo, I wanted the Times and Seasons, which was the periodical published by the church at Nauvoo. It came out twice a month. Joseph Smith was editor until his death. In it, he tells his own story in his own words. John Taylor was editor subsequently. Well, things had been changed so greatly that the Tanners of Salt Lake, who had spent 30 years blasting the church, put out a new edition of the Times and Seasons in photocopy and sold it as anti-Mormon literature. Now, that's where I got my Times and Seasons.
Very good. Well, I'll come now to a book you published in 1978, Rocky Mountain Empire, The Latter-day Saints Today. And incidentally, you'll notice the clever title to this session, Rocky Mountain Umpire, A Conversation with Sam Taylor, and a play on that title, Rocky Mountain Empire. Now, this book is an account of the what you call a radical metamorphosis of Mormon character between 1885 and the present. And the first half of the book, which you subtitle Latter-day Laocoon, suggests that the church has struggled not altogether successfully, perhaps, with change in the areas of polygamy, politics, and finances. And the second half, which you subtitled Happy Valley, deals with eccentric and colorful individuals, chiefly from Utah Valley, where you grew up, but also, as I recall, from certain personalities from the San Francisco area, where you have read. Now, we'll take these one at a time and ask, see if you'd respond to a few things on this. Now, in the first part of the book, Sam, you make an ironic contrast between the official prohibition of polygamy of today and the continuing vitality of underground polygamy among the Mormons. And I was wondering what your attitude toward underground polygamy is as we see it today.
Well, I wouldn't want to undergo the harassment that they have to face. But I think it's their own business, and we should leave them alone.
Have you ever been tempted to take another wife, Sam?
Well, I was sorely tempted once. I was overseas for 2 years, and my secretary was a beautiful whack. She was petite, fastidious, with a great sense of humor, and she was there. So we fell in love. But I knew what my father would have done, both my grandfathers, but times had changed. So I was married. She was engaged to a sailor in the Pacific. And so we never slept together. It was a beautiful relationship. We saw cinema together and shows put on for the troops. We took walks in Hyde Park. After D-Day, we attended a fashion show in Paris. And at the end of the war, when I kissed her goodbye, it was without remorse or regret. I still have a soft spot in my heart for Helen Gill.
Thank you, Sam. Thank you very much.
My wife knows about her.
Sam, do you want to enlarge it all on Happy Valley? You know what's happened to Provo and Utah Valley today. Do you have comments on that?
What do you mean exactly?
Well, do you like to go back to Provo? Do you approve of Utah Valley? Is there anything that's changed that shouldn't have changed there?
Well, I wouldn't recognize the Provo that I knew, because it had, in my childhood, just about 10,000 people.
Did you like it as a boy there? Were you happy growing up in Provo?
Oh, yes. Yes, indeed. And things were different at that time, too. At that time, polygamy had been officially abolished, but what most people don't realize is that there was more than the 1890 manifesto and another in 1904. There were about a dozen of them, each pinching off a loophole until the absolute final Heber J. Grant manifesto of 1933. So polygamy was alive and well from 1831 to 1933.
Okay, thank you. In the second part of the book, Rocky Mountain Empire, among the colorful figures you treat is Bishop John H. Coyle of the Dream Mine. Why were you attracted to Bishop Coyle?
Well, it was a good story. I was selected among about 20 other GIs at Fort Lewis, Washington, to go to the ASTP Officers Training Center in Salt Lake City. And by the time we arrived, the whole thing had been scrubbed. So I remained a buck private. But my brother Raymond drove up to say hello and goodbye, because I was on the way overseas. And he told me about Bishop Coyle and the Dream Mine. So I got an overnight pass and went down to Spanish Fork and interviewed Coyle. And he said, "Well, it's too bad that I can't talk to you now. Next week I can talk, because next week we're going to strike it big." Now, this had been going on every week for 49 years. this man was a charmer. He almost sold me stock. He had these dreamers who believed in the dream, and they worked in the mine for stock which had no par value but would make them wealthy next week when the mine came in. And so I sat up all night and I knocked out the story and sent it to my agent, and he placed it with Esquire magazine. I was overseas when it appeared, and Raymond wrote me saying that the church authorities considered the best thing ever written to expose Coyle as a fraud and worse. And the dreamers said it was the best thing ever written to prove the authenticity of Coyle as a prophet. Now, I've never done that again, but I did it once.
You did.
Now, a number of the chapters of this book, Rocky Mountain Empire, are devoted to Joe Budrow. Now, that's yourself. Is that correct?
That's right.
Would you talk to us a little bit about Joe Budrow and why you selected that name and took that position on yourself?
Well, there was... Every quarter at BYU, particularly at the beginning of school, the students would come down and stay at the Roberts Hotel, where I was night clerk. And all of them signed Joe Budrow. I don't know why, but they had a group. And so all these students signed the register Joe Budrow, and he became a local celebrity because he was visiting so often. And so I became Joe Budrow in turn. I used to sign registered the same way.
All right, thank you. You said that, Sam, that you were inactive until 1962. You called yourself an eating Mormon. And I'm quoting, one who attends ward dinners. what happened? How did you get off being an eating Mormon?
Well, it was actually 1952, but
it was 52.
Yeah, my book, Family Kingdom, as I said, I had been advised not to write it, and I thought maybe I would get cut off for doing it. And after it had been out long enough that nothing happened and probably nothing would, I walked into the Redwood City ward and said, "Where do the humpbacked, gray-haired, and beat-up deacons go?"
Oh. Well, characterize a little bit your ward life for us. You have had then a close and comfortable ward life in Redwood City Ward. You've been an active member of that ward, and you've enjoyed it. Is that correct?
Oh, yes. It's it's a nice feeling. You feel like you're with good people, and I've been blessed with liberal bishops because... I'm known as the gadfly of Redwood City Ward, the carping curmudgeon. But somehow, I still remember.
Sam, tell us, you've mentioned your brother Raymond, and I think you were exceptionally close to him. Is that true? Do you want to talk a little bit about Raymond?
Oh, yes. Raymond and I were very close, and he did the major research for the book, The Kingdom or Nothing, about John Taylor. Now, as with Family Kingdom, we had been warned not to write about John Taylor because the B.H. Roberts had written the life of John Taylor, and it was a great book, and that was sufficient. Well, I kind of differed with that. B.H. Roberts devoted 139 pages to the 10-year administration of President John Taylor. Now, in all those pages, he mentioned John Taylor by name about a half dozen times. His material on John Taylor would have fit on one page. So I figured the definitive book about John Taylor hadn't been written yet. And Raymond, as I say, did the major research. And he rushed in where the angels fear to tread, and he came out with the goodies. He got so far into the archives that he went out the other end into orbit, and out there in a department which doesn't officially exist, he found 23 boxes of John Taylor's correspondence. So, in effect, he was sitting at the president's desk reading the mail. And he sent me a letter every day about his research, what he had found, sometimes twice a day. He must have sent 1,000 letters. And, as I say, the church didn't want John Taylor. You see, he stood for things we have abandoned. And so they appointed an assistant apostle. They had assistant apostles at that time to find out what Raymond was doing. And Raymond played a game with him because this assistant apostle was rather plump. He loved his meals. And Raymond timed his own lunch hour in the Lion House just as the guy was sitting down to eat. And he'd leap up, leaving his lunch, to go over to see what Raymond had been doing that morning. Well, this game went on quite a while. And one day, Raymond returned from lunch. His briefcase was gone. He kept a carbon of everything he sent me, and the briefcase was missing. He says, "What happened to my briefcase?" "Are you sure you brought it in, Brother Taylor?" Well, he had made several calls before going to the church archives, and he wondered, maybe he had left it somewhere else. So he sent me a check for $100 and said, "Xerox everything I sent you." And I sent the check back and I said, "Raymond, your briefcase couldn't be in safer hands. When the Xerox machines cool off, you'll get your briefcase back." 2 days later, here his briefcase was by the desk. "Where did this come from?" "Well, you brought it in this morning, Brother Taylor."
Thank you. I think we're getting to the end of the notes we have on the interview, and I think there would probably be nice to have questions from the audience. There is a friend of yours here, Sam, named Jerry. Jerry, you said, have you say something for a moment.
It's just been so wonderful to be in this session today. Sam and I have been very close friends for about 35 years or 40. Sam, or can't you remember? Because I can't either. Anyway, I used to live in Redwood City, went to the Redwood City ward before the old deacon got there. I never, ever met him in that ward. The one thing we have in common is we both have 36 brothers and sisters. But the other thing we have in common is, and I just want to tell this quick story, is that about a year ago I finished a little novel, and I finished a manuscript and sent it to Sam. I live out in Duchesne County. And he'd say, "Oh, no, not quite yet. You got a little transition problem here and something." And so I'd change it. Everything he told me to do, I changed it. One day I sent him a manuscript, and he wrote back and he said, "I think you've got it. I think you've got it. Now, when are you going to send me the end of the novel?" And my heart sunk. I thought, the end? I sent him the whole thing. I wonder if he's lost. I sent it all to him. He says, "No." So I wrote and said, "You got it all." He says, "No, I did not get the end." He says, "Now you think about it. I did not. You have not written the end yet. Think about it." So I was kind of in a fury in my mind. And so I took my long walk down along the Duchesne River, sat on a stump where I can cool my mind down, and I thought, he said, "Think about it." So I thought about the ending. And with that thought, and this happened, and I tell this to school kids when I go out about this book and talk to kids about writing. I tell them this experience, and it fascinates them. I said, I sat on the stump and thought about it, and in my mind, I could see the last chapter. And in my mind, it was too long. And right while I sat on that stump, I thought, well, the format of the book is short chapters. That's two chapters. Two chapters. And it was all done. It was all written. It was all revised. It was all edited. All done in my mind. How did he know that? That's what I don't know. Unless it's his rapport with just writing. Anyway, after that, he wrote the introduction to the little book called Jex. And because you're friends of Sam, or you wouldn't be in this session this hour, I would like everybody here to have a copy of Jex. It's in hardback, and it's being distributed on the East Coast, but I have some extra paperbacks. And I put a box on each side of the door there, so when you leave today, please take a copy of Jex. And if there shouldn't be enough, I would like to put some more up on the benchmark book table, if that's all right with you folks, just to give away these paperbacks. Thank you.
Thank you. The man with my face is available at Benchmark Books, we've just heard. All right, please, questions? Either way, if you've got an elaborate statement to make, come up.
I have a question. I have a fairly reliable source that says that your father really was not excommunicated in terms of church records. One of your relatives that was born in Farmington, when he went on a church mission, he went to visit his mother, who was one of the wives of John Woolley Taylor, and she related the story that when John Woolley Taylor died in Farmington, I believe it was, the Relief Society was preparing the body, and a knock came on the door late at night, and there was Joseph F. Smith with a shoebox. And he said, "You'll need this tonight." And they opened it up, and it was his temple clothes. And so this fellow went into church headquarters and went through the minutes of the excommunication, and he could not see where John Woolley Taylor was actually excommunicated. Is this true or false?
Well, there's wheels within wheels. Officially was, and the family believes he wasn't, but as long as it was on the record, I wanted him reinstated. My brother Raymond started in 1925 trying to get him reinstated. In 1965, 40 years later, I was working in Hollywood at the time, and Raymond phoned me, and he says, "Now is the time. You know Hugh Brown. Now is the time to get Father reinstated. Get busy. Contact Hugh Brown." Well, I don't know where he got the inspiration, but I wrote a letter to Hugh Brown asking what steps needed to be taken to reinstate my father. And I was working at the BYU Motion Picture Department not long afterwards, and he phoned and said, "President McKay wants to talk to you about the reinstatement." I said, "Well, he really wants to talk to Raymond. He's taller, he's better looking, he has a better church position, he's more articulate." He said, "Brother McKay wants to talk to you." So I borrowed the studio loaner car, an ancient Chevy with bald tires and no spare. My daughter accompanied me, and I drove to Salt Lake, and I talked with Hugh Brown, and he said, "Be brief. Be brief." At that time, David O. McKay was very feeble. He was sharp mentally, but good for about a half hour a day. We worked. And so, President Eldon Tanner arrived, and I went with them up to the 8th floor of the Hotel Utah. And President McKay had a tube taped to his nostril, and there was a little bloop, 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 giving him oxygen. And when I came in, a nurse appeared, and he said, "Oh, breakfast." And I helped roll up his sleeve, and he got a shot. And then I presented my case briefly, and he said he was a confrere of my father in the quorum. He said John Taylor was a good man, and President Tanner says, I move we approve this, and it was approved, the reinstatement, and a short time later, Raymond stood proxy while my father was reinstated to his former position, priesthood and blessings.
Thank you. Another question? We have till 6:15. Do you feel all right about some questions, Sam?
Oh, yeah, sure,
please. He says it's understood that you were once locked in the closet by one of your teachers. Is this true?
It's all too true. I attended kindergarten at Brigham Young Academy. That was before the Y was the university. And the teacher was Ida Smoot Dusenberry, the sister of Reed Smoot. Now, of course, I can control my love of Reed Smoot, and apparently she couldn't stand the Taylor kid, so every day she tied me up with a rope and put me in a black closet. And when I'd get home every day, my mother'd ask what I learned, and I'd say to take little bites. That's all it was that I learned in kindergarten. So my mother was flabbergasted that I didn't continue my education at BYU, that I enrolled at the Parker School for first grade, where Edith Young, Brigham's granddaughter, was my teacher.
Okay, good. Another question? All right. Let's see. Let's take one here, please.
Just a quick one. In Heaven Knows Why, would you say, where would you say in your mind that was based?
His question is, the novel Heaven Knows Why, where is it set in your mind, in your thinking, about where would that have been set, that novel?
Well, when it was running as a serial, the great sport in Zion was figuring out the exact location that it was. And it must have rung true because people decided it was anywhere in Deseret, one little town after another, that was really the place, and my characters were real people. They didn't seem to understand fiction as such, were real people, and some of them prominent. One person wrote me and wanted to know the name and address of a character who was an apostate. Apparently she wanted to put the missionaries on him.
Sam, where can one buy that substance in that novel called Coffee Near?
Is that real?
I'm afraid not. But actually, there was a good coffee substitute. Most of them are repulsive, but this one was good. And according to my story, a man stumbled on it by accident and called it coffee near. This, of course, is fiction. So that's the story of coffee near.
Well, what I understand from reading your novel is that coffee near exists for those that don't know it really is coffee that they're drinking. All right, one more question, please. Okay, please.
Did your father have a sense of humor, and what was it like?
They want to know whether your father had a sense of humor.
Well, yes, he did. He wasn't prone to joking, but he had a good sense of humor, and he had thousands of friends. During his last sickness, he sat under our apple tree in the front yard, and a stream of people came day after day to say goodbye.
Okay, thank you. Well, thank you very much for your attendance.